So tell me this, where in East London could you find a fully functioning guillotine from 1825? And how could you turn your clothing into stationery? It's Friday the 28th of June 2013, I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud. London, Michaelmas term lately over.
London?
Okay, you know where you are. A radical transformation.
Very radical transformation.
People are morally outraged with what's going on.
I got very excited this week.
Seems reasonable, doesn't it?
As soon as you scratch the surface, you realise gore happened all across London. Every open square would have a gallery.
At a place called the Kittle Hoosie, saw ye Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey.
What the hell is that?
But a man is tired of London. He's tired of
so
life.
So what was the first thing that caught your eye?
The South has an overstuffed walrus.
It's very important history.
A handwritten letter from Charles Dickens.
There's a piece of information we're missing here somewhere.
You sneak through the city, immersing yourself in the sight, sound,
and
song,
for the Jewish community, who came over in their tens of thousands from Russia, from Poland.
We are doing a modern take on Morris dancing.
When did he think the Second Coming was going to happen?
Yes, Boris. He wants to put an airport.
the tone with which Boris has announced that is fatigued.
Yes, the city is always changing. People frequently say to me, you know, won't it be wonderful when it's finished? And I say, no, it'll be dreadful. It'll mean it's dead.
Inform and entertain. That's what it's about.
London is a modern Babylon.
That's very true.
Can we have some of the detail here? Well, hello from a very sunny Fish Island, which is a little known area of London. It's in the sort of Hackney Wick industrial artsy zone. I would say in the shadow of the great big red ArcelorMittal Tower, but it doesn't really cast a shadow that long. It does maintain its position on the skyline from every roadway. You can see it in the Olympic Stadium. And I'm here at a beautiful old warehouse, lovely tall windows with light streaming in, and they're streaming in to the London Centre for Book Arts. Its founder and the chap running it is Simon Good. Hi, Simon.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, not bad. It's a glorious morning. I think we've put the winter blues firmly behind us. Well, I hope so. It's going to snow tomorrow now, I've said that. What is the London Centre for Book Arts Festival?
LCBA, I'll refer to it as that from here on in because it's a bit of a mouthful. LCBA is an open access resource centre for artist books and book arts. So to explain a little more about that, we offer teaching and education in the traditional sort of craft subjects of papermaking, bookbinding and printing. But as well as that, we also have a community of artists that, or hope to have, because we've only recently opened, and we hope to have a community of artists that are based at the centre, that use the centre as their studio, and that work in the book form or in artist publications, or they might be doing, you know, a wide variety of things, but all connected back to the book.
And what I didn't realise, I think, is that this place is unique in the country, right, in terms of what it's doing.
Yeah, it's the only open access centre. It's the only place that members of the public can come and partake in workshops and then come and have access to all of the sort of rare and hard to find equipment that we have here to make their own works and to collaborate with others who might not, you know, who might be specialists in other subject areas. So it's hoped that it becomes a melting pot for people who, you know, you might get poets or writers who want to come and typeset something traditionally and print it letterpress, and so they might collaborate with a binder then to produce a limited run of works, or you could have a paper maker working with a printer. So there's a lot of room, sort of there's a lot of scope for people to work together and to work individually on their own projects here.
That's very exciting, very exciting. And you've mentioned the equipment, and we should say a word about this. The gadget gene in me started firing up the moment I walked in here, and there's some pieces of equipment around that clearly look as though they get plenty of use. The covers have come off this morning. Mm-hmm. I know you've got a workshop coming in later. There are other bits of kit here which I almost feel a stage set dressing. I'm not sure how much use they get, and we're talking here in the latter case about great big wheels with cogs, and there's a thing over here that looks like a wine press, and so on and so forth. I mean, does all this equipment get used?
Yeah, it does. The funny thing about a lot of this equipment is that the crafts that we teach and that we practice here are obviously ages old, and they don't make them like they used to. You can't buy bookbinding presses like the wine press that you refer to. You can't buy bookbinding presses like that really nowadays, new. And so a lot of the equipment that we do have is antique. That thing over there, that big cast iron thing, is you can't quite see it.
Is this the one that looks like over there, the one that looks like a phone box, that one?
No, that one's it.
We're heading towards a thing. It looks like it's got a cartwheel on the top and a couple of cartwheel-sized cogs on the side. In the middle, well, it's very elegant and embossed metalwork, but what it's for, I couldn't possibly guess.
So this is it's an 1830s, 1840s guillotine.
So all that for a guillotine?
Yeah, that's the blade there. And then this wheel, that lifts up the clamp that holds the paper or book or whatever it is that you're chopping in place, and then these gears here just move the blade up and down. So yeah, it says that the company was established in 1825, but it looks like, because it's a bit of a later model, sort of like 1830s, maybe 1840s, but it's very over engineered for what it needed to be. It weighs an absolute ton. I've moved it a couple of times now. I plan never to move it again.
So I can hear the residual fear in your voice.
Yeah, it's funny. It's got a funny story. This one was donated to us from the Centre for Fine Print Research, which is over in Bristol, and they in turn were donated it from the widow of Ted Hughes. He used to produce his own small press publications and stuff for friends and family, and this is the guillotine that he used to trim his work on.
Astonishing. So, I mean, there can't be many of these items, each individual item that are scattered around us. How do you go about tracking one down, and how do you know what you need in the first place? Where does this information come from?
Well, yeah, it's a funny one that it, I began collecting the equipment the year after I graduated. I did a course of BA Book Arts and Crafts at the London College of Communication, and during my course we learned all of the sort of craft bookbinding techniques and letterpress printing and all of that sort of stuff, and so I was already familiar with the equipment. And the situation I found myself in was that I wasn't able to continue making work like I had been doing on my degree course, because it was all so difficult to, you know, find. And so that's what started me collecting, really. And it was just a case of a long time trawling eBay and Gumtree and Loot back in the day.
Well, it must be that everybody who came off that course who took a serious interest in it afterwards, you must all be competing with each other for this stuff.
Not necessarily, because the stuff is so heavy and sometimes expensive, but more importantly, it's heavy, it's difficult to move, you don't really want it in your living room. I don't think this would probably live in my living room because it's a bit too heavy.
So you're the one who showed commitment, you're the loon of the group who really decided to go for it.
Yeah, and it took me, what, 6 or 7 years to to amass all of this stuff, so it's not a quick thing. You couldn't go out tomorrow and be like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna buy myself all these things, because they do take time to hunt down and to find, and that's why we exist, really, so everyone has the opportunity to use these things that are important. You know, they're important things, and they're nice to use, and I think there's a pleasure in using this equipment that you might not get otherwise.
Well, that open access part of it suddenly makes a lot more sense, given the specialist nature of the equipment. But the centre itself is in its infancy.
Yeah, no, I moved everything in October, November last year. And we really only officially opened in February. So we've been open a couple of months now. So it's very much in the early days.
And how do you go about getting the word out, because of course we know that Fish Island isn't the most populous place, and that's why it's a delight for a lot of artisans and craftspeople to be working here, but how easy do you find it to draw people to this place?
It's not so bad. I do get a lot of the you know, the typical, oh, where's Fish Island sort of questions, but now we've got the overland at Hackney Wick, it's not so bad, and since the Olympics I think that has sort of put it on the map somewhat.
Let's be absolutely clear, Hackney Wick is a great place to get to, because you've got Stratford one stop away, and everything's connected to Stratford now thanks to the Olympics, so Hackney Wick really very ideal, and you're a 5 minute walk from that station.
Yeah, it's 5 minutes down the canal as well, so it's a nice little walk. And soon that I think I hear that they'll be opening the fence to the Queen Elizabeth Park as well in the coming months, apparently. So that'll mean that we'll get hopefully a bigger footfall.
Have you got a relationship with the whole Olympic experience?
Yeah, well, I only live down the road in Hackney Wick, so it's not a far commute from home to the studio. I was here last year for the Olympics.
Talk us through the last year of your life.
It wasn't so bad. We got to go to the opening ceremony, the practice run, which was nice. Because we got a letter through the post saying, we were eligible to get tickets, and so we didn't. No, it was really nice, and sort of sat on the balcony for the on the rooftop for the closing ceremony for the fireworks and all of that sort of stuff. It was a little bit busier, but because you couldn't really get into the park from Hackney Wick, it wasn't that bad. I was a little bit peeved about the fact that they'd shut down the towpath on the Olympic side of the canal. That was a bit of an annoyance because that was my regular cycle route. But apart from that, it was fine. It was good.
Yeah, a lot of people I know seem to think that it was going to everywhere here was going to be swamped by cigar chewing Americans, and apparently nothing of the sort really happened.
No, they didn't. And it's interesting, the unit that we're in at the moment. During the Olympics was going to be some sort of pop-up restaurant or kitchen or something like that. And eventually, I don't think they got planning permission to do it, or they weren't allowed the events license from the council to run the shop. And so it didn't ever happen. But I think it seems that a lot of people around here had rented out their spaces to people that were wanting to do events throughout the Olympics. And then nothing, it sort of fizzled out somewhat.
Like that big renting bubble that everybody thought was going to happen there, make millions.
I was thinking about this actually. There's a water taxi just outside the big foreman's place that was here during the Olympics, but I vaguely remember them closing the canal down so no one could actually get near the Olympics on the canal. So I'm not sure how effective the water taxi was in the end.
Not massively, not without water being involved, no. Let's talk about some of the processes going on here. I just, as I came in, the almost the entire left side of this warehouse space is devoted to racks and racks of things that have almost certainly got a technical name that I'm about to learn. The little blocks with letters and symbols on them, the sort of things that presumably you'd slot into some sort of spot on a printing press. Can we talk about how all this works?
Okay, so this is the letterpress typesetting area. Over here we've got cabinets of type. So you've seen the cabinets already. Each one of them has got individual bits of metal letter in them.
And they're all the different fonts, are they?
Yeah, all of the different typefaces.
Now what's the difference between a font and a typeface? You corrected me there. What's the difference?
A typeface is the case itself. The single, so we've got Times Roman in 12-point, and that's the typeface. But the font is the collection, so it'd be Times Bold, Times Roman, Times Italic, and so on. So that's the whole thing. To have a font, a full font, you can appreciate how much space it takes up just for those. In the olden days, it would have been, racks and racks of it.
And does this represent, I'm not sure what normal would constitute, but if you were doing the same sort of job 50 years ago, would that represent a full collection, or would you be looking at room after room of this stuff?
That's a very modest collection. You would have had like double height racks up to the ceiling full of stuff. This is like a small, your local equivalent of Pronto print type high street printer with a small press. That's it. This isn't something that large printers would have had.
And you've taken out a thing. It's about the same size as a box of Kleenex or something like that, fairly flat. And we can see, I feel like I can make out some words there.
Yeah, so this is what they call a form. And this is all of the individual letters that have been composed and then locked into this metal thing here. This is called a chase, but when it's got work in it locked up, it's called a form. So there's two different words for the same thing. And I can't actually remember what this is.
See if we can read it backwards. It's art colon works usually. This is much more difficult than I thought it would be.
Mind your P's and Q's. See there, that P.
Oh, yes, right. That's not a P at all. What is it?
No, that is a P.
Oh, that is a P.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it looks like a... Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Somebody should make an expression.
Yeah, I agree. So this is, says, arts, works usually produced by the use of skill and... What does that say?
Crevices.
Creative. Creative information. No? Imagination, sorry. It's a very small typeface.
So, something that strikes me straight away is that that justification to both sides must be pretty difficult here.
I tend not to justify things. It's left aligned, usually.
Is it even possible to do justification in the same way that we would do on Microsoft Word or something similar?
Yeah.
Your eyebrows just went almost under your hairline there.
It's not really something I ever try and do, but it is possible. You'd have to do it manually. So you see these things here, these little bits of metal, these are used for spacing out words.
These are at the end of the line. They look like sort of spare spaces after the final word in each line.
Yeah, so you get varying thicknesses of that. So you would use really, really thin ones between each letter to space everything out.
Wow, so that would be the most tedious job in history.
Yeah, if you're doing it by hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got our form here. It's all set up to go. Now, what do you do with your form?
So you take it over to the press to proof.
Over we go. We're walking past a couple of machines that have got lots of rollers, spindles, and what looks like a supermarket checkout conveyor belt going on each one.
So this here is the proofing press. And if I just turn it on, I shan't ink it up because it takes a while to clean.
So the form has just been sort of viced in place, face down.
So that's locked in now and it's not going to go anywhere. So that's all ready to ink up and print. And so what we would normally do is ink this roller here and then...
This is big. This looks like the barrel of a machine gun.
Yep. And so that roller is engaged and that distributes the ink evenly.
Okay, and that's at the same time as it's rolling, it's also moving oscillating. About 2 or 3 inches. Oscillating, yes.
It's an oscillating roller, yeah. And so to pull a proof, you would feed your paper in here. I'll just get a sheet out. And we grip it in there like that. And then engage the rollers. Oh, like that.
Now, that looked as though it required quite a bit of strength in the arm.
A little, just to get it going.
Is that a movement that requires technique? Is there an art to doing that, or is it just a brute force, off we go?
Not really. I think you can... It's fairly simple. Once you're getting into the swing of things, just go. And you can... If you go quickly, you can get a few done a minute. These machines are designed to proof things, so they're not designed as production presses. You wouldn't produce like 1,000 of something on one of these. These were traditionally used to, you know, proof magazine or book sheets, just to make sure that everything was, you know, just right. And so you would give this to proofreader to do corrections and what have you.
And do you have the equivalent for sort of mass production going on here?
No, not really. These are great because they're easy to use, they're friendly. You're not going to lose a hand in one of them. And you can get a really, really good quality of work. They produce really nice prints and they're really good for sort of experimental stuff. They don't take long to set up. And that's the important thing. Because they don't take long to set up, you can work really quickly and sort of swap things out and change colours. That's slightly different. You can only print one colour at a time. Mm-hmm. On one of these presses, really. Unless you're doing manual inking with hand rollers, then you can only do one colour at a time. But that can sometimes be quite fun.
I'm guessing that the word digital might not go down too well here, but what I'm really interested to know is whether, as with, for example, old vinyl LPs and stuff, there's a warmth to the sound that people would argue you can't get elsewhere. Is there an inherent quality in this form of printing that makes it superior to more up-to-date forms?
It's not that I'm anti-digital. I quite enjoy the both of them. Let me show you a sheet that I've printed. And you can see over here. Here we are. So this is a proof of something we did the other day, which is it's just fairly simple. It was a card that we were printing, but this wood type here is that wood type there. So you can see there that.
Right, and that's the very bold, clean lines there. I mean, I walked past that earlier, and I certainly didn't guess that that was done using blocks of wood.
Yeah, no, so this is, it's, I've got a bit of a thing lately about using a fade, so you do one colour one side, one colour the other, and then roll it in together so it fades in. And it's just really nice, like, you get a really, really good, nice, clean impression. And that's often the case. People like letterpress because it, you do get a really nice sort of slightly indented surface to the print, and I think that's what really sets it apart, as well as the fact that, you know, you can just do loads of really cool stuff.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 16,000 titles, try the Audible service and 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to a CD. And they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
Well, let's unpack some of the cool stuff offered here at the LCBA. There are a whole range of skills that people might want to acquire in the pursuit of book arts. I mean, it's such a lovely general term, isn't it? It could encompass all sorts of things, from the manufacture of the paper itself, right through to what's put on the paper, how the papers are bound together. What's the landscape of this skill set?
Well, we have facilities for paper making. So, like you say, making your own paper by hand. We also have, obviously, the letterpress printing and bookbinding and facilities for bookbinding and all sorts of related techniques and processes. But the good thing about it is that you don't have to do all of them, or you don't need to do all of them to be involved in, you know, book arts or making your own books. We might just have printers who want to come and print small books or invites or cards or something. It's not that I'm discouraging the, you know, the printing of those sorts of things, but it is nice that, you know, to eventually have people who are going to produce small bookworks and their own sort of stuff like that.
And really from scratch, so it sounds as though somebody could come in and really make the materials, print it, and leave with a book.
Yeah, I mean, you can't print a novel because we don't have enough type. There are the means to be able to do that.
Well, okay. Now, one thing that strikes me about the place in particular is the cleanliness of it. In some respects, it almost looks a little bit like a museum. There are display cases, what look like display cases, with tools visible. And it's not the sort of... I was expecting ink everywhere and sort of ink-stained people trudging around with great big... And particularly making paper. I'm not sure what I expected. How come it's so nice and tidy? You're not working hard enough.
I had a bit of a tidy-up in the last week. No, when we have paper making, it does get quite messy. We are currently, when we do paper making, it is just for workshops at the moment. Still saving up to build that paper making studio, so it's sort of a medium term thing. But we have the most important piece of the paper makers arsenal, which is that metal thing over there. That's it looks like a big food processor, sort of. It's like a trough with a big serrated blade in it, and that produces, it's called a paper beater, a Hollander beater, and that processes paper pulp, so you can put whatever in there, cotton or rags, and process them into pulp to make paper from. And you can also use basically anything that has cellulose fibers in can be made into paper. So 100% cotton garments like jeans can be cut down and made into paper pulp. You can also recycle paper as well, and people tend to like to make paper from plants. So you can make paper from, I hear the net, I'm not a paper maker myself, although I've done a fair bit of it. I hear that nettles are quite good for paper making with, which is quite handy because we've got a lot of them around here.
Right, yes. There's an entire Olympic site that needed clearing at one point, so presumably they've got a pile. Why would people make paper out of those things?
I don't know.
I mean, it just seems like a lot of hard work.
It does, but then I think you need to appreciate the joy in making. I think that's the important thing. It's not about the final product, really, is it? It's about the process. And I think, actually, the more that these sorts of processes are demystified, the more that people understand how a sheet of paper is made, and then can relate that back to how the paper that they use to write their shopping list on is made, I think maybe it'll go some way to increasing people's understanding of how books in general are made. And I don't know, yeah.
No, you often hear that sort of sentiment expressed in relation to food and farming and understanding where your food comes from. A gardenista, yes. I think maybe. I mean, let's do some demystification right now then. I'm standing here with my Holland mixer and nothing else. How do I go about making some paper, step by step?
So it depends what you're making it from.
I'm wearing a pair of jeans right now, so let's imagine that I've had enough of these, and I wish to turn them into a greetings card.
So we need to make sure that they haven't got any plastic in them.
Right, so I'll take my wallet out first, shall I?
Well, no, more importantly, that the fibre mix isn't, that it's 100% cotton, that you haven't got any viscose or whatever else, elastane or whatever else they put in.
What sort of person do you think I am?
Just check it. So your 100% cotton jeans, what we're going to do, because you've been wearing them for a very long time and they're already quite worn, then the fibres are going to be on their way to being, you know, processed down to the individual strands. So they're a good pair to use. What we're going to do is chop them up into small pieces, say centimetre squared. We'll get rid of all of the seams and the sort of the hard bits that the beater can't process. And then I think we hydrate them for a while. Put them in a bucket of water and leave them for a day.
Oh, as simple as that. I imagine some more complex process.
Hydration. Shall we go over here?
Yeah.
So once we've done that, we can then put them into the beater. And the beater tends to take, it can take anything from 45 minutes to a couple of hours. And what the beater does is slowly you adjust the height of the actual blades, so it starts off quite wide, and then after a period of processing, what it's doing is macerating the fibres in the paper in the cotton of the jeans, and so it's pulling it all apart into its individual strands of cotton, and eventually once it's processed, you'll have a beater full of pulp, and that pulp's ready to go. So you can then put it into the vat, which is basically a big deep plastic tray full of water, and use the mould and deckel to then start forming sheets. So this here is the mould and deckel. It looks very primitive, doesn't it? It's this is the mould.
And we're looking here, I should describe them, I suppose they're... If I was making a little mesh to go over a tiny window to keep the bugs out, I guess this is what it would look like, a frame with very fine metal mesh over the top of it.
And then, yep, and then over that frame goes this little frame. And what you do is dip. I wish I could show you with some sound effects, but what you do is dip the mould and deckel into the paper.
Splash, shake, shake.
Yep. Splash, shake, shake, drip, drip, drip. And you move it somewhat, a little. And what that does is, as the water flows through the mesh, it leaves the cotton on the top, on the surface. And then we take the deckel off.
That's the wooden frame on its own.
And then we're left with a sheet. And then we can then... cooch the sheets.
I think you're making some of this up, you know. I think you're creating a job for yourself by mystifying us.
No, it really is. We cooch the sheets onto I can't remember what they're called. Sorry, I must apologise. I'm not actually a paper maker, but I have done it a few times, so I know sort of the terms. My paper making tutors will be able to tell you the proper process with the real names. But no, there definitely is. It is definitely called... cooching. So it's the process of pressing the mesh onto the surface for it to be able to then be taken over. Once you've completed your run of sheets, you would then take it over to the press and press all the water out of it.
Oh, I see. Right, so what you turn out from this this mesh thing, it'll be sort of a rectangular patty, and then you put it through the mangle.
Yeah, sort of. It's a rectangular patty of patty. A rectangular patty of really soggy cotton that gets interleaved with sheets that when it gets put into the press, you push all of the water out of it and it leaves the cotton fibres, and what they do is then they fuse and create the sheet of paper.
Oh wow, so it's done through compression at the end of the day as well?
Yeah.
What about, how do you get a straight edge in that? It sounds as though that might end up in a crazy edge.
Yeah, you get what's called the decal edge, which is often quite sought after. People like a decal edge because it shows that a sheet has been made by hand and not by a machine. You don't get decal edges on a machine necessarily, so you know.
That's fantastic. So my genes are now have been literally pressed into service,
and you'll have a sort of gene coloured piece of paper, because obviously we're not going to bleach it or do anything nasty like that, so you've got a sort of bluish sheet of paper. But you can always mix your fibres together, so if you wanted to have a little bit of gene and a little bit of virgin cotton fibre, so you've got a bit of white in there as well, you can do that. It's really versatile. You can make paper from virtually anything.
While we've been talking, I suddenly realised that you're wearing a denim shirt, a denim apron, a denim jeans. You know, sometimes when you need a bit of spare paper to scribble something down on, I assume this is the backup plan.
Oh, I just think, I don't know what I was thinking when I bought denim aprons for the studio, but
I remember you mentioned you did the course from which a lot of this sprang. Where did your interest spring from before that, though? Why book arts?
I remember that I was studying on my foundation course back at home in Walsall. And I had a couple of tutors who were really, really interested in printmaking and in small publishers and small artist books and editions and stuff like that. And they really encouraged me to take what I was doing during my foundation course, because at that point, I think I was 18, 19, I didn't really know what I was doing. Was doing lots of sort of printmaking, screen printing, stuff like that. And they encouraged me to start making small books, so small editions of works and picture books mainly and things like that, artist books. And I think it was during, I was looking through a prospectus and saw that the course existed, that there was this thing, this book arts and crafts, the course was called. And I don't know, it's struck a chord and I thought, that sounds perfect. That sounds like what I want to do. And it was a really strange class, a course at the college, LCC. I think there were 23 people in my year, so there weren't many of us. And everyone had a really varied background, so some people wanted to go be illustrators and to illustrate books. And then there were some people who wanted to be, you know, jobbing bookbinders, who were working in binderies. And so there was a real wide variety of people. And it was good, it was bad, it was a really strange mix. But so I graduated and carried on making, or at least attempted to carry on making my own work and commissions after I'd graduated. But without access to the equipment, it was really difficult.
You mentioned a chord being struck, and I really just want to draw that out a little more, I guess. What do you see in the process that attracts you to it? Is it, for example, is it a fine art thing? Is it alternatively a sense of having produced an artifact of one sort or another? What is the thing that that brings you pleasure?
I think it's the, for me personally, because I was always quite interested in industrial printing processes and how things were made. I think like all boys are. Like, how's that made? You know, you remember seeing like videos as a kid of in the factory or on the production line, and it was always that sort of thing. Like, I was always fascinated about how these beautiful, you know, I'd go to Magma or places like that and see all of these amazing art books and wonder how they were made. And sort of, I think it really opened my, when I did the course and we were doing, using processes like letterpress and foil blocking and these sort of really industrial processes on a small scale, it really sort of, I hate to say demystified again, but it really did, like, it was easy, basically.
I've got to put it within reach of you.
Yeah, and that's the important thing, is that you realise that all of these things, these industrial printing and production methods, are basically scaled up versions of what you can do by hand. It's not the other way around. Yeah, you know, they stem from hand, you know, hand production by hand, which I think was really interesting. And it's not, okay, I think I'm quite biased actually, and I am merely interested in production and how the things are made and stuff like that. But also, it depends, you know, it depends who is working at the centre. If you have, you know, we have space and facilities here for people to be bookbinders and to make beautiful leather-bound tomes. And while it's not necessarily my skill set, I appreciate that. And I've tried to make available equipment and the tools to be able to do that. And the same with the papermaking. Like I say, it's not my strength, but I appreciate and understand that it's important to be able to teach people it, and to have these facilities, so like access to a beta, because they're really expensive and, you know, it's not like they're particularly easy to come by. But by allowing people to come in, you know, rent the beta and come and beat whatever material it is that they need to process, they can then just take home the pulp in a bucket and carry on, you know, working from home. So it's just, you know, it's, there are varying ways that people can be involved in the centre. And we're also going to have an exhibitions programme soon as well. So that's going to be another thing that we can offer, and we can, you know, another string to our bow.
I know as well the path to setting up the LCBA involved a road trip across the States.
Yeah, I took 3 months out of my full-time job. Because I, as well as setting up the studio, I work full-time at a university. I don't teach at the university. I just work in the communications publications department. But I took three. They were really kind and let me have a three-month sabbatical from my full-time work to go on a research trip around America. So I went from, basically I went from New York to LA via the Midwest, and I think I went to probably about 15 cities, but spent a lot of time. I spent 3 weeks in Minneapolis at the Minnesota Center for Book Arts, which was quite nice, and that was basically what started me off. That was to go back a little, Book Arts has existed in the US for quite a long time. Centres like this, where it's a community centre with access to resources for teaching, and all of that sort of stuff, they've existed in the US for 30-odd years. The one in New York is the oldest. And so 30 years down the line, we still hadn't got a centre similar to the ones in the US. And so, I mean, that was my starting point, really, and that's what I've modelled this place on, were those sort of book art centres that had access to all of the stuff, that offered everything. And I've sort of had to, you know, select aspects of it that I liked and bits that I thought didn't work quite as well, and have attempted to somehow not emulate it, but have a similar thing here. So I'm not copying, I'm doing a London version of, because obviously I understand that it's Minneapolis is a very different city to London, and people that, you know, the people that are going to come here are very different to the people that are going to go to the Minnesota Center for Book Arts. So, you know what I mean? It's sort of taking what they've got and then tailoring it to London.
That seems very appropriate, really, to the sort of processes we've been describing here, a kind of a uniquity and a tailor-madeness about the institution as well as about the products themselves. Simon, thanks very much for taking the time out. I know you've got hordes of keen book arts craftspeople descending on you shortly to participate in the various workshops. People can find out, of course, about how to get onto those workshops. You've got a website?
We have, yes. If you go to londonbookarts.org, you'll be able to find us. We currently have a list of workshops on there as well, so there'll be an up-to-date list of workshops, and there's information about the show that's coming up as well.
Good, so people can just drop in and have a look at what you're doing there and get a flavour for things as well. And of course there's always a festival. I think it got cancelled last year because of the Olympics, but there's generally a sort of an open house thing that goes on in Hackney Wick each year, which you may or may not be involved in. It's in early stages at the moment, but that might be another way that people can access the LCBA.
Also there's a supporters of the centre. So you can become a friend of LCBA for £35 a year. I just want to upsell it. I don't know. Maybe I can't. But that gets people discount on all of the workshops and stuff like that. Come and have a look. Come and have a go. Come and have a bind, a print and a bind and a cooch.
Yes, come and have a cooch. Simon, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks. She stands.
And that's all for this week. Thanks for this week to Simon Good. Thanks to Tibeca Evans and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Roy Anderson. I'm N. Quentin Wolf. Waiting for the river's care. Straining for the blooming waves calling from the shore. See you.